From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Congressional Quarterly, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, and our moderator is Shana Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Thanks for joining us. Here are the issues. The U.S. presidential election enters its final stretch. We'll look at how both candidates are driving their message home with voters. And a second coronavirus wave. Countries around the world face a troubling rise in COVID-19 cases as the weather turns cooler. Plus, the U.S. sets the stage for another Arab country to make peace with Israel. We'll discuss what that could mean for peace in the Middle East. Jonathan, Josh, terrific to have you both this week. Let's start with the election. I think it is fair to say this is the final stretch. It feels like we have been in this election cycle for 10 years at this point, but it is actually coming to an end soon. We've got under 2 weeks to go. So as we get in these closing days, Jonathan, give us a sense of where the two campaigns stand. What message are they trying to get out there to voters?
Well, Biden is trying to present his agenda for his presidency, and that agenda includes addressing the COVID crisis first and foremost, and then the economy, and then some other issues that Biden is trying to tie to the COVID crisis. So that would mean things like childcare and immigration. On the other hand, President Trump seems to be focused on attacking Biden, and there hasn't been very much meat to be seen on his agenda. He's really sort of avoided presenting any sort of plan for his reelection.
Yeah, and I want to just bring up Hunter Biden for a moment, because this is really a narrative that the president and his allies have been pushing, that Hunter Biden, they allege, not only cashed in on his father's name, but that Joe Biden, when he was vice president, they allege he abused his position to not only help his son, but to enrich himself. Now, the latest twist is this New York Post article where Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal attorney, says he obtained Hunter's laptop and that there are these emails on the laptop that proves what the president and his allies have been alleging. Now, there are a lot of holes, as you pointed out, Jonathan, in this story. First of all, other media outlets have not been able to get access to this laptop to verify its contents. There hasn't been other evidence that Joe Biden did anything wrong. Some Republicans even are wary. They say this smacks of Russian disinformation. And of course, Rudy Giuliani is involved, and he, critics say, has been on this quest to destroy the Bidens and has been meeting dubious characters in order to make that happen. With all that said, Josh, what is the political impact of this story in your view, especially if more so-called revelations come up in the next few days?
Well, more revelations have just come up, in that you've had Hunter Biden's ex-business partner apparently coming forward with a statement saying that these emails are true and that he was involved in these business deals in China and that Joe Biden was taking a cut. Now, we've got to treat all of this carefully. I mean, these are pretty big allegations, and they're coming from people who, like Rudy Giuliani, who have a history of, you know, engaging in the dark arts of politics. But I do think we need to take them seriously, and I do think there's been a failure so far in the broader media to properly look at these allegations. There isn't really that much evidence of Russian disinformation that anyone's presented. Their political impact is difficult to ascertain because, well, they're not being that widely reported. So they've been restricted to conservative media at this point. One isn't really even able to spread the stories on Twitter, who have shut a lot of this down. I do think it's fired up the Trump base a little bit, who were maybe feeling a little bit down in the dumps because it's given them something to talk about. It's a little bit of a redux of 2016 when the president, or the Donald Trump rather, then was going on about Hillary Clinton's emails and her email server. And there's a feeling that they've got their teeth into something. Whether it really changes any votes, I think a lot of people probably want to hear more about issues like healthcare, like COVID, like the economy, which Trump also probably should be talking about more. But it might sort of puncture Biden's good guy aura a little bit. It might sort of make a few people think, well, aren't they all as bad as each other? Biden's been quite effective at presenting himself as a, as a sort of very angelic relative to Donald Trump candidate. So maybe it has a little bit of effect on the margins, but it is difficult to tell at this point.
Yeah, I will just say that the Senate has looked into some of these allegations, and there wasn't evidence that Joe Biden did anything wrong. Even if Hunter Biden may have done ethically questionable things, it's his son, it's not him. And Jonathan, as you pointed out, a lot of this hasn't been verified, but it'll certainly, Josh, as you say, it's certainly getting a lot of buzz in the conservative media, and President Trump has really latched onto this. It'll be interesting to see whether it changes any minds, or if basically at this point everybody's minds have been made up. Jonathan, I want to go to this story that's developing, especially since you're the national security expert here. John Ratcliffe, a top U.S. intelligence official, came out and he says that they have evidence that Russia and Iran want to meddle in the election. I mean, it's not so surprising, but more surprising is that Iran is behind these recent emails, these spoof fake emails, allegedly from the Proud Boys, this far-right group, threatening Democrats that they have to vote for Trump. What do you make of these developments?
They're a bit confusing, partially because Ratcliffe hasn't really given very many details about this, the background behind it, or how they found this out. What's clear is that I think the Iranians probably got the information that they needed from the voter rolls, because in order to send out these emails from public sources, I mean, they didn't, there's no evidence that they hacked into the voter registration databases.
Because voter rolls are easily accessible. I mean, some of them are public. It's not so hard to get access to that information.
Yes. For example, the news conference raised more questions than it provided answers. Ratcliffe basically said that the motive behind these emails was to damage President Trump. That's a little bit difficult to understand when the emails were basically threatening Democratic voters to change their registration and vote for Trump. So that kind of doesn't compute very well. Also, national security experts maintain that it is very, very difficult in the business of espionage and spying and dirty tricks and these sort of things to assess the motive of those who are doing it. Probably the best explanation that one can come up with at this point is that they're simply trying to sow confusion among the American electorate and erode confidence in the Democratic voting system.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm not going to say what his intent was there, but it's likely to make the Trump administration or people that are allied with the Trump administration look really shady, and that discredits the campaign in general. But as you say, what it is doing at the end of the day is sowing more unease in the security of this election. And you see just sort of a general unease among voters that I've been speaking with, that there might be disruptions at polling places, that mail-in ballots won't be counted correctly, that the armed militias are going to show up on election day. It certainly seems like a very different election cycle this year. But if we look at the polls, Josh, so far the polls show that Joe Biden is ahead, but I don't have to remind our listeners, I'm going to do it anyway, that polls 4 years ago showed Hillary Clinton winning, and she is not president. So what do we make of that? Do you see something different in polling this year?
Yeah, well, this is the question that everyone's tearing themselves to pieces over. One thing to remember about 2016 is that the polls did tighten considerably towards the end. So although they did show Hillary Clinton marginally ahead, she wasn't very far ahead on election day. At the moment, the polls are tightening a little bit, but Joe Biden still has a fairly healthy lead in the states. So the question is, are we missing something? Is there a shy Trump vote out there? Are people not polling Trump voters effectively? Are they sort of not wanting to see the pollsters, or is there the kind of hidden support for Trump out there? If there is, it's pretty well hidden at this point. But Trump's not out of total reach either. You know, if he's 5 or so points behind in places like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, he's very close in Florida, where they've been spending a lot of money and putting a lot of effort in. So it won't take a huge shift for him to be within the reach of a polling error. So if something happens, say this Hunter Biden story really does blow up, or say but Trump eviscerates Biden in the debate, or something, some other surprise, then it's conceivable that he's within striking distance, and maybe there's a polling error, maybe he pulls an inside straight, as the poker analogy that many people used last time. I think it would be foolish to count Trump out, but equally, one has to look at the evidence in front of one's eyes. This race has been very stable. There aren't many undecideds. Biden's lead has been fairly consistent throughout. Hillary Clinton's lead, on the other hand, moved around quite a lot. You know, all the evidence in front of our eyes suggests that Biden is quite comfortably ahead. But yes, we are haunted by 2016 and the errors that were made then. And also, we've got to be honest about how effectively one can truly predict an election, which there are limitations to this process.
This is true. And on that note, let's take a pause here and we'll come back after the break.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Congressional Quarterly. Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, and our moderator, Shayna Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome back. We're talking about the U.S. presidential election, less than 2 weeks away. I want to ask you, Jonathan, because I have a couple more questions on this topic. Obviously, this is a huge story. But even if we were discussing the polls before the break, even if the polls are correct and a majority of Americans plan on voting or have voted for Biden, Trump still might win because this comes down to math. I'm going to try to use my high school civics here, but the U.S. doesn't have direct vote. We have an electoral college system. Presidents don't win by the popular vote. Each state gets a certain amount of representatives. These are electors, and they cast votes on behalf of the people in that state, so that if most people in California vote for Biden, then the electors of that state cast their lot with Biden. There are 538 electors around the country. Whoever gets 270, the majority, they become president. But because there are these smaller states with fewer people that tend to be Republican, critics say in this electoral college system, Democratic states that are more populous are underrepresented, and Republican states that have fewer people are overrepresented. And thus, Trump still might eke out a win. So how nervous should Democrats be about this math?
I think that, you know, remembering what happened in 2016, I think Democrats are nervous. I mean, they're happy that the polls show that Biden is ahead, but they are considering very much, as Josh has said, the possibility that Trump could, while losing the popular vote, could eke out a victory by getting the electoral vote. I might add, though, however, that one of the sort of more, I think, disturbing elements of this election cycle is that Trump has been appealing to state legislators to ignore the popular vote in the event that Biden wins the popular vote, and to award the state's electors to him. And this would basically nullify the popular will. So there is concern about that. There's also, as you mentioned earlier, the concern about the ability of the post office to handle a huge surge, expected surge in mail-in voting, because people want to avoid the possibility of contracting COVID by showing up at a crowded polling station. There was data that was released, I think, just yesterday, that showed that in the battleground states, in most of the battleground states, particularly Michigan, Wisconsin, and Georgia, delivery of first-class mail, which is what these ballots would be, is something like 70% of just before the political appointee that took over the U.S.
Yeah. There's a lot of unease around post office and mail-in ballots, although I haven't seen any evidence that state legislators are planning on listening to what President Trump said. So we want to just be careful.
Sure.
People don't get too freaked out here. But I want to jump on, you're talking about COVID-19 and why people are uneasy to show up to vote in person. Let's talk about the coronavirus pandemic. We're 7 months in now. There was a dip in cases, but We're seeing cases now rise around the world. Global cases this week passed 40 million. Here in the US, we're seeing cases go up in nearly every state. And in Europe, countries there, the UK, France, they're starting to impose new restrictions. Josh, there was a sense that Europe kind of got this, that they were handling it better than the United States. How do people there feel now with cases rising and these new restrictions?
It's a pretty bleak feeling. I talk to my friends and family in the UK a lot, and it's a fairly grim sentiment coming out. You know, people are going back into second lockdowns, and it looks like a long winter ahead. There are some glimmers of optimism. One is that the vaccine trials are moving ahead at a reasonably good, rapid clip, and so the British government is projecting that that they may be able to deliver some kind of vaccine to vulnerable people by the end of the year, which would be obviously very good news, and then try and roll it out more widely next year. And the treatments are getting a lot better, so that the death rate from COVID, even if you are relatively vulnerable, is lowering over time. So we're not seeing quite the same fatality rate that we were back in, say, April, which is obviously very good news. Nonetheless, this is the second wave that everyone feared. And Europe, you're right, did somewhat have the explosion of the virus under control over the summer in a way that America didn't. But it's now back, and it's back really all over Europe, even in countries like Germany that had a pretty good run at it first time around. This is the second wave. It's hopefully the last true wave until we get some sort of vaccine. But people are really, everyone I speak to in Europe is sort of putting their seatbelts on and preparing for a fairly bleak midwinter.
Well, Josh, you are correct. New studies have come out that show that the death rate has dropped significantly, but people are still dying. I mean, this is not a low-risk virus. Hundreds of people are dying a day here in the United States. There's over 220,000 deaths overall since this pandemic broke out here in the U.S. Jonathan, it's fall. It's getting colder. The winter months will drive people indoors where public health experts say the virus spreads more easily. How worried are public health experts about what we might see in the coming months?
Extremely worried. Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's the expert on viral diseases, epidemiologist, has warned quite blatantly and openly that and forcefully that with the cold weather coming on, the death toll could reach 400,000 by the end of the year. He's urging people to wear masks, to socially distance, all of the prescriptions that have been out there for some time. The problem is that the administration, and particularly the president, has been downplaying the seriousness of the pandemic, and he makes fun of those who wear masks. He's made fun of Biden for wearing a mask, and I think he's left himself vulnerable to the charge that since he himself contracted COVID, that how is he expected to protect the country when he can't even protect himself and those in the White House?
And he's not only making fun of people who are wearing masks, as you point out, as he has with Joe Biden, but he's also been attacking Dr. Fauci in recent days. Josh, is that a successful political strategy to do that? What do you think the president, where's his mind on that?
You know, I'm not sure it's a strategy at all. I think the president is a pugnacious operator, and if he sees someone contradicting him in the public sphere, he'll pick a fight with them. Obviously, Dr. Fauci is a esteemed and respected voice as a doctor and on the coronavirus, so it's not someone you would naturally want to go up against, and that's probably why Trump hasn't fired him. But at the same time, you know, Trump supporters like the fact that he's always warring with the establishment. They like the fact that he takes on people who are revered in liberal circles. It might not necessarily hurt him. It might just be another Trumpian ding-dong and will be forgotten in a couple of days. But yeah, it's not really what you'd want from a president, given, as you point out, the vast and ongoing death toll that we're seeing from this virus. I think he should be trying to work hand in glove with the medical professionals and not teasing them or attacking them for their bad baseball pitches. It does feel rather puerile, frankly, when you look at the gravity of the broader situation. But that's who the president is. It's who he's always been. He's a fighter and sometimes a troll. And he's not going to change now.
We have seen that over the past 4 years, the president has certainly not changed. I want to move on. This week, the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced that the U.S. will remove Sudan from the State Department's list of countries that sponsor terrorism. Sudan, an Arabic African country, has been a base for terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda, but now they're agreeing to pay tens of millions of dollars to American victims of terror. But this, of course, is not really the end of the story. Analysts say this is much more about normalizing relations between Sudan and Israel. Jonathan, why does the U.S. want Sudan to have better relations with Israel?
The reason is that President Trump wants to have a very decisive foreign policy victory. Now, if you remember, the U.S. brokered agreements normalizing relations between Israel and the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain in August, and then they had a signing ceremony at the White House in September. At that time, the United States was predicting that, or President Trump himself predicted that at least, I think, 5 or 7 other countries were about to normalize relations with Israel as well. Now, this, of course, would, I think, energize American Jews, not so much because they have such numbers as to sway an election, but because some Jews are very, very big contributors to political parties. And because Trump is lagging behind Biden in raising money for his campaign, Jewish money would be very, very welcome. What I might add is that in the Sudan, they split in the government, the new government that replaced the Islamist government of Hassan Turabi, and the one that was accused of fostering terrorism. The military very much wants to normalize relations with Israel. However, the political people on the ruling committee is very wary of this because the street in Sudan is still very pro-Palestinian and very anti-Israeli. And they're afraid of the consequences of what could happen in the street if normalization were to occur. Well, let's not forget that when Egyptian President Anwar Sadat made peace with Israel in 1979, he was assassinated 2 years later by his own army.
Right. And that's what you're hearing a lot in all of these sort of moves in the Middle East. What about the Palestinians? It's interesting you bring up Jewish support for this, because I think a lot of people would also say this is also about the evangelicals, since they're big supporters of Israel and they are a considerably larger voting bloc. But very quickly, Josh, you know, the president hasn't had a lot of foreign policy victories, I think it's fair to say, even if his team would probably push back against that. The deal with China, the trade deal, is on shaky ground. There's no deal with North Korea. European allies feel alienated. But in the Middle East, putting aside no deal with Iran, is it fair to say that the president has had some successes?
I'm not sure I'd entirely agree with your premise, actually. I think there have been some significant foreign policy victories. I think the general change of tone against China is probably one of the things that this administration will be remembered for and has become very bipartisan in Washington.
That's fair.
I think they've had success again taking out Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, taking out Qasem Soleimani. They haven't launched any foreign wars, which I would say is a foreign policy success based on recent American history. And I think these deals in the Middle East, and I agree with you there, I think they're much more about evangelical support for Israel than Jewish money. But I think they are relatively successful. They don't do a lot for the Palestinians, that's for sure. But they do normalize relations between Israel and other Arab countries in a way that points to a different future for the Middle East. And we're going to see trade and travel between places like UAE, Israel. And I think that's something that wouldn't, even 20 years ago, would have been difficult to imagine. So I do think they've had some success there, and I think they deserve some credit for it.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're out of time here. Otherwise, I'd spend a little bit of time pushing back against me. But I think we can agree there have been some foreign policy successes, primarily in the Middle East, certainly at that. All right, that is all the time we have. Thanks to Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Congressional Quarterly, and Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Shana Stulen. Thanks for listening.